Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all know what? I hate when I do that. I hate when I do all that talking and you all have no idea what the heck I just said. I'm sorry. Let's start this over again. Good morning, everybody. Look, we're still messing around with the video piece, trying to get that situated started. We got to do some digging in that. We got to make this make sense. And all that feedback that we got last week wasn't cool. So we're going to continue to rock with Facebook for the moment. We'll do some testing this week and nail all that stuff down. But until then, say less, say more. Here we are. We're going to talk about allyship, partnership, as we did. We dove into a little bit last week, but we dove into it without actually having any partners on with us at the time. So Rodney reached into his Rolodex, flipped a couple pages. It wasn't far. It wasn't long. It was actually the next page over, and he had a whole list of folks that he reached out to, and they're going to come join us today on the show for the ride. So here we are, and that's what's up. Before we get too far into it, today is the 26th rotation of my baby boy. He is 26 years old today. He is definitely my oops child. It is what it is. He's the oops child. Look, him and his brother are 1 year, 2 weeks and a day apart. Yes, that's a oops child. He's healthy. He's been a handful, but he has lived for 26 years. So, you know, federal statute of limitations will not allow anybody to get at me for murder because I didn't kill him yet. I done told him a couple times I was going to kill him. I just ain't killed him yet. So, happy birthday, baby boy, on your day. Definitely enjoy it. He's the first, and I predicted this as well. He's the first to make me a grandparent. I have a granddaughter on the way. I think I said something about that last week. That's interesting, thinking that my youngest son is about to be a father. Just I'm nervous. I'm nervous. Yes, I am. The boy's special. He's special. He is. But yeah, hey, weren't we all at some point? So he has to start somewhere, really figuring it out. So 26 years later, he's going to drop his first. He beat me, you know, obviously, because I have a 31-year-old too. So he damn sure beat me. And that was my thing. You know, I just wanted my children to have the opportunity to explore before they started having children. And they had the opportunity that whether they took it or not is a different story, but they had it. So there it is that it was. The middle boy, he's 27. Yeah, because they all just had their birthdays. Everybody's born in freaking January. So it's 31, 27, and 26 now. Cheese and bread. You know, I'm saying that now. In a couple of years, I'll be saying he's 40. The oldest is 40, and I'll really be having a freaking cow at that point because I don't know. Well, there's no thing about being ready. You know, there's no way of doing that or saying that. But, you know, 40 is fast approaching for the oldest one. And he's doing it, so you know I'm very proud of him for doing his piece to live his life before he settles in and settles down. So you know hopefully it'll pay off even better for him as he gets older. Sister Rashi, good morning. How are you?
Well, you're about to get my Barry White voice. Are you ready? This is what I woke up with for some reason. I'm well. I feel fantastic. There's no problem. But for some reason, I woke up as Barry Lou Rawls this morning.
Mm-mm-mm.
And now I understand why my son sounds like, you know, Mufasa.
Oh, right. You think you rubbed off on him a little bit?
Yeah, now I'm not going to keep clearing my voice. Wow. It don't matter. I could keep clearing my voice 100 times. This is what it is today.
Someone's trying to call me. I don't know who that is, but I can't see you. If you're trying to call while we're doing the show, so give me some time, and I'll definitely call you back, family, whomever that is, and hopefully you all understand and recognize that it's showtime right now.
Yeah.
So I can't do both.
It's funny you should say that. I had to actually leave where I was and go somewhere else in order to do the show today because the place I live is pretty festive right now. So, you know, we journalists and broadcast writers, artists, there's something mm-hmm. about the nature of trying to transfer something clean when you want a message put across. It can't happen with a lot of chaos usually, you know. So they'll understand. They'll understand.
They'll get it. You think they will?
Well, I'm impressed, by the way, I meant to tell you. So what is this, four or five different ways that you're getting us out there? iTunes.
Trying to.
You know,
so,
Facebook,
yeah.
iTunes, Instagram, Blog Talk. You understand what you're trying to navigate?
Right.
You doing
right.
This is it's its own job, multimedia journalism. I don't know what they call it, multimedia communications, whatever it is called.
Well,
you're
simulcasting. Yeah, with simulcasting.
Whatever, man.
Right.
You are doing that shit there, brother. Work it.
Yeah. Well, you know, we got to do some testing. I was trying to get with Rodney last night to do some fine tuning. And really knock that down and iron it out, and that just didn't work. You know what I'm saying? And it's okay. We'll get to that point without a doubt sooner rather than later. So because everybody's been looking for, and it's working. The other side of it is we're getting more views and we're getting more hits, and that's what I knew would happen once we started doing it. But as I explained to Rodney, you know, I threw it out there a couple of years ago. But once I threw it out there. I shot it down almost immediately just because of the way I work and not knowing my schedule and if I'm going to be off on Saturdays or, you know, what type of environment I'm going to be in. So now that it's pretty stable that I'm off and, you know, I can be at a normal place. If not, even when I'm traveling, I can have a more controlled environment for it. It's just better to do it that way. So it's definitely something. Okay. It's definitely something that I wanted to do. It's something Rodney wanted to do. And I think it's going to pay off beautiful for us in the long and the short. There's another project that I'm working on, too, and once that comes into fruition, I think it's going to just take us to a totally different level because, obviously, I'm going to be blasting the show through the entirety of the project. So that's what's up with that, okay? So yeah, it's crazy right now, but it's cool. It's cool because, it's one of those things where I feel like the next step that we need to make is right here, right now. So why not? You know what I'm saying? And that's what it is. That's all that it is. And
I'm trying to find a place where we're broadcasted, you know, where people ain't running, walking past me with their shirt off, you know, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
I'm trying to find a place where kids don't come in. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I gotta meet some sound. Give me a second. Yeah, I'm definitely feeling that. Give me a second. I got to mute some sound. I definitely got to mute some sound. Okay. Yes, and that is very important because you don't want to be in the craziness of it all at once. You do want to be in a situation where you can be seen, you can be heard, and you're not getting massive amounts of feedback like we were getting when we use StreamYard, which is one of the reasons we moved away from that, at least for this week, so that we can figure that out. And there's some things that I've been doing some research. There's things that I found, so I'm going to check on those over the weekend and balance that out and see if that really works for us. And that's what we're looking forward to. We're definitely looking forward to it. We have to go in that direction. Everything is moving that way. We have to join, or we're going to get left behind, and we're not going to get left behind. What's up, Brother Barry? I see you. Sister, how are you? Good morning to you. Good morning to you. Thank you. Welcome for joining us in the video there. Brother Barry, can you hear me? Just nod your head if you can hear me. Brother Barry, can you hear me? Oh, okay. I don't think he can hear me. Let me see. Brother Barry, can you hear me? Thomas, can you hear me?
Can he just type in? He can't hear you.
I don't know why he can't hear me, but... hold on. Let me see something. Yeah, can you hear me now? You can't hear me at all? Okay.
Are you trying to replace that dude? He left the dude.
Nah.
Can you hear me now?
Nah. Oh, you know why? I know why. That's why. Can you hear me now?
Okay.
Yes, you can hear me now. It's the feedback issue. So when you all come in, you have to come in muted. And then if you want to talk, just let me know, and I'll bring you up. But if you come in hot, it's everything's coming in at once. So I found this, virtual board that I'm going to start playing with today to see if I can neutralize that. So I had to mute you all. In order to not kill the show, I muted everybody in order for us to be able to move forward. You got me? You dig? Cool. Gotcha. All right. Well, welcome. Welcome. I love you. I love you. Okay. All right, y'all. Look, I'm sorry. We're playing this whole video thing. And again, like I told Rodney, yes, Rodney, we're using the link from earlier. And I think we have one of your guests on already, actually. Yep. There she is. So, yes, Rodney. Doing this and doing the show is hard as hell trying to run both of them at the same time. So that's another thing we got to work on, because that ain't going to work, you know, because somebody along the way or something along the way is going to get forgotten without a doubt. So, but it's cool. It's cool for now, and we'll just move on. What was it going on? So, yeah, we're talking about the united front of all of our people in order to promote and push forward with the Black agenda. So that is the goal and the purpose of today. In addition to that, we'll talk some sports. That's why I definitely reached out to Brother Barry, because last weekend was bananas. It was straight bananas. Like, I'm watching the games on Saturday, and no home team won until the Chiefs won. And I'm like, okay. And then Brady went home. I think that's going to be his last hurrah. I really do. Everybody knows Roethlisberger is done. He retired. And I'm proud of him for making it known sooner rather than later. He didn't drag it out. He didn't, you know, well, I'm going to talk with the family and see. No, he was like, look, you all need to move forward without me. I'm done. This was the last hurrah. I appreciate it. I'm done. Aaron Rodgers is back to Aaron Rodgers to do. He doesn't know what he's going to do. Hence, the Green Bay Packers don't know what they're going to be able to do. They have Jordan Love in waiting. Is he the answer? Don't know. But they may give him the ball for a year or two to see what he has in the tank and then go from there. But if they do and Aaron Rodgers does move on, be it retirement, which I don't think he's going to do, but just does move on to another team, where does he go? And then the question, too, is how does that shake up the rest of the league? Because, you know, Russell Wilson is also waiting to make a move. Teddy Bridgewater is still out there. What's going to happen in New Orleans now that Sean Payton has stepped away? Is Winston going to be back on the market? Is Winston going to have a shot at winning the starting role again? What's going to happen in Miami? It's so many questions right now. But, yeah, this playoff weekend was just bananas. It was absolutely – like that freaking Kansas City-Buffalo Bills game was one to the eight. Oh, Lord, here she go. Go ahead. I'm listening. What's happening in Kansas City?
I can tell you what Kansas City gonna do. All right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm making my Kansas City prediction for tomorrow, okay?
Okay.
And only because this is we write for, we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get back up and down and handle some business in 13 seconds, right?
Mm-hmm.
13 seconds? Then why can't we just treat it like every 13 seconds? You know what I'm saying? Just go out there and act like this is a collection of 13-second games.
Seconds, right.
And I think we're going to go head on and finally give these people something to get drunk to for a little while.
You think so?
Taking this toll on the psychology of our players. They are throwing vacuums up against the wall and like they tripping in their personal lives because of the pressure. So if we don't go, it's not because they didn't have the talent. It's they just, you know, crumble like most do under the pressure of trying to be champion, you know?
Mm. Well, it is – that game was remarkable. That game was fire. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it, to categorize it. My question was and still is this the coming out of Mahomes? Did he just take Brady's place? That's my question. Did he just take Brady's place? Because to me,
he got more heart than that. He got more, and he ain't all hyper Christian like that. What he just did was put himself. I wish he had a more Africana identity. Honestly, he put himself in the place to be one of the great
You know how we do the Walter Payton, the I want to do this right. Warren Moon. I'm pulling some old footage back here.
Yeah,
you
digging in that crate.
Okay.
You digging in that crate.
But these were quarterbacks, am I correct?
Warren Moon was a quarterback.
Walter Payton
was a running back.
Okay, not Walter Payton there.
Yeah, so
it's another name I'm trying. It's another black quarterback from back in the day.
Randall Cunningham.
Yeah. So what we doing is we marching up. I shared a chart one time about how many running backs are black. How many, you know? And then as you go up, like to the owner, it's like no, there are no black owners, you know. So we trying to push our way up, you know, but make sure that we doing it the right way.
Okay.
Through the organization and not from outside of the organization.
Okay. Well, the Rooney Rule is still in effect. Organizations have been doing is giving more people play in the back or the front office than they have on the sidelines, because there's a stipulation in the Rooney Rule that you can do either, and it still gives you the compensatory picks. It still adds to your compensatory picks. So they've been playing that like a fiddle in order to get around actually giving coaches an opportunity. There's no reason that Flores got fired in Miami. No reason. That kid was finally putting together a team that could do something. There was no reason he got fired. I'm sorry. Dave, did you want to say something? I can't hear you. Is she talking to us? I don't think she's talking to us. Okay, I think she muted us because she's talking to somebody else. Okay, that's the other side with this thing. You got to figure out who people are talking to. Hey, Brother Barry,
just tell them to put up the church finger.
I know, right? Well, you know, yeah. You can hit the little thing, and it does raise your hand so you can get an opportunity to talk. So, Brother Barry, I don't know if we can hear you through the podcast if you're just talking through here. So, okay. There you go. Yeah, do that. All right, that's what's up. Yeah, because I definitely want his input. He said he's going to hop on. He's going to hop off and hop back right back on. Let me see. Rodney, where you at? I'm trying to get you in here, too. So, because he's working the back as he always does. He got people calling him, blowing him up, trying to get this whole thing situated. But I'm sorry. So my question about this weekend, again, was did he step into that path or that track to be considered a GOAT? Because that game was crazy. I've never seen anything like that.
And it almost makes you feel like somebody that made a bet, and if they lose, somebody was going
to
get killed or something. And they was like, no, he's going
to
kill my grandma if we don't win.
Like they had
and
the grandma in the basement. I'm not even the same thing.
They got my grandma,
had grandma
in the basement. We got to win.
Like Biggie said, you know, grandma been locked up in the basement. Okay, Deja, are you talking to us? Just nod your head if you're talking to us. Are you talking to us? Okay, let me bring you up. Well, you're muted still. She's muted still, so I don't know how to bring her up. All right.
So
we're going to bring
the
guest
on. It ain't nothing but festivities. We're all, and it's the second Christmas for us always in Kansas City when we get a decent win. And I'm so proud that he's not, you know, that we got another. His daddy is black. I don't care how people look at him. You know what I'm saying? That man's
right.
Daddy is a black man. You know?
That doesn't. I mean, it's important, yes, but that doesn't matter. The skill set, the athletic prowess that he executed on that field that day, I don't care about that. Honestly, it was purely brilliant. And let's give Mr. Hill his credit too, because one does not happen without the other at all. So that's how.
Yeah, we just gotta, as far as my brother says, please trust that a lot of the information I get come from him. If we can stop people from scoring on us, even as fraction as well as we score on them, then it'll be we could become dynastic, you know?
Yeah. Well, defense usually wins championships, but the way that cat swings the ball, they may win without it. They may win without it. I mean, I don't know. It's going to be a great. It's going to be a great game.
It was like 75 points. What was that? 80 points? I stopped counting.
Yeah, me too. Because
it was like.
Yeah. It was insane. I mean, my heart was all over the place. It was just insane. It was just insane. Like I said, I've never seen a performance like that. For Buffalo to come out and score a touchdown in 6 seconds, and then for the Chiefs to counter in like 12, 14 seconds. Are you serious right now? Like, where was the defense? There was no defense. And we can pontificate about this game all day for the next 300 and whatever, how many days left in the daggone year. It was that daggone good. But again, the bigger thing is, did he just push Brady out? And Brady was all about, I want to be 40 and still quarterback. Well, he did that, right? Did that game just set a standard that he has to look at himself and say, I can't do that anymore. I don't have it in me like that anymore. I'm still good. I can still get it done. I can't do that. That I cannot do. And that's okay. It's better for you to be able to stand up and say, you know what, it's time for me to sit down, than for you to try to grind it out forever and someone hurt you. And,
okay. Well, if he is getting the pass the baton, I prefer it not be Brady, okay? I prefer it be someone more loyal, more psychological, with no smear stains on his back, somebody who hasn't been conditioned and primed by a man like Bill Belichick with his, personal condition. And so I would prefer, if he's being passed, ain't no retired black quarterbacks, man. Ain't no black quarterback said never mind lately or what?
No, I didn't know. No. That is no.
Hey, I don't know if it's about passing the baton. I really think that really sports is going back to the team rivalry thing versus the individualized player thing that you kind of seen ushered in with the NBA and Michael Jordan. And I think that they need more rivalries in sports because the individuals, you know, like you can make money off of selling individuals, but it really works when people are more so about the team. And so you see that with basketball now, where it's really getting more, less about when they flip the page in the LeBron era, you know, they won't be talking about individuals anymore. It'll be about team makeup. You'll start seeing that a lot more because when it's a rivalry, you can sell more.
The sport is more popular. Yeah, the sport is better. I mean, you need those rivalries. You know what I'm saying? In order for the sport to flourish, if you will. Because, you know, now you have steel sharpened steel. So now you have cats going out here really building, working. They have a goal in mind, and the goal is just beyond the championship. The goal is, okay, I got to beat the snot out of you in order to get to the championship, and I'm willing to work that much harder to ensure that I beat the snot out of you. And, you know, this is a lot that has been lost in our caring society, and you know, because we have a lot of spoiled children, and they don't believe in any type of work ethic or doing as very little but they want to get the maximum return off the littlest effort possible. Littlest, that's what I said, littlest, not smallest, littlest, that's what I said, possible. So, you know, it's just one of those situations, man, where the Chiefs and the Bills are locked in. Who joins? Are the Bengals really a threat? We'll see, because now the Chiefs are about to play the Bengals. Are they really a threat, or are they still the little kid that's trying to be in the grown-up, at the grown-up table and in the grown-up sandbox? We'll see. You know, the Ravens, again, we thought this year, as a Ravens fan, we thought this year we had a chance. Well, injury plagued us. Coronavirus plagued us. We're not ready to sit at the big kids' table yet. We're still at the little kids' table sipping on juice pouches. And, you know, that is what it is. Hopefully in 2-3 years' time, we'll be at the big kids' table. But that's not where we are yet. And you have to realize and recognize where you are and who you are. You Dallas Cowgirl fans, right? You all pumped up. You're going to the ship. We're going to the ship. We're going to the show, man. We're going to the Super Bowl, baby. We're going to – hey, Dak is back. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm sitting there the whole time saying, it's going to deflate. It happens every year. It's the nature of the Dallas Cowboys. They give you a good show. Look, man, they give you a good show, and then when it's time to put up a shut up, they fall. I'm sorry.
Well, let me say this about my Cowboys, and it's similar to your Ravens. You need championship pedigree to win championships. Mm. The problem with sports today is people listen more to the talking heads than they actually do the history of sports. You never see a team like the Cowboys, who've been struggling to make the playoffs the last two seasons, go directly to the Super Bowl. You have to take your lumps. You also need championship pedigree on your roster, which we don't have any, and you don't have any. All those Ravens from the past that won those championships, they're no longer there. So who's going to teach those young guys how to win? Who's the veteran quarterback on your roster that's coaching Lamar up? Who's the veteran quarterback on the Dallas Cowboys roster that's coaching up back? Who's the veteran wide receiver that's coaching up the wide receiver club?
Hold on. As far as veteran quarterbacks for Dallas, didn't you have Andy Dalton done it?
What championships have you won?
Okay, I'm just saying. We're talking
championship pedigree and people who actually know how to win. The issue that no one wants to talk about in all industries, you need to have people who have winning experience and knowledge teaching you how to win. The Cowboys mantra has...
So that goes into our conversation for today. I just want to put a pin note right there, because you need experience and wisdom along with the youth. We'll bring that back around in a couple of seconds. Keep going.
So for me, I just say this with all things, is that you either going to believe what they're telling you out of their mouth or what you see. I watched my Cowboys, and I know what I saw. I knew we were going to be one and done, not because of what they were saying about anything in the past. We had a lot of holes. When we lost to the L.A. Rams the last time we were in the playoffs, we had a poor linebacker in the soft middle. You could run the ball against us. How we lose to the 49ers? They didn't get better linebackers. They didn't get no better defensive tackles. So you're going to lose the exact same way if you don't change those things. We're talking about championship aspirations. And you got an owner who says, I'm just going to build through the draft. Well, young players don't help you win Super Bowls. So if that's what you want to do, you're going to be one and done. So for me, watching sports is real interesting, because the people who won are winning. Look at the 49ers. They've been to the Super Bowl. Their quarterback, he knows how to win. He came from the Patriots system. Even the head coach went to the Super Bowl with the Atlanta Falcons. So they know how to win. Then you look at the Chiefs. Look at the Chiefs and what they're doing. Championship pedigree, championship coach, championship quarterback and core. They know what to do. Look at the L.A. Rams. They've been to the Super Bowl. Only team that hasn't been to a Super Bowl who's going to get knocked out is the Bengals, because the Bengals got the luck of the draw. They played the Raiders, right? And I honestly believe that the Raiders and the Cowboys, week one of the playoffs, had the two worst officiating crews that any team could have. But I also believe that's because those are the two teams that beat City Hall and won. They're the ones that sued the NFL and won. And that's why anytime you see their playoff exit, it's always mirrored in controversy. But with that being said, experience and championship pedigree, it does matter. And so when we talk about anything, that's what that there's no get rich or get or win fast formula. You have to earn your way. Kansas City had some heartbreakers with Alex Smith as quarterback against New England, right? And then against the Colts. Then they had the heartbreaker against New England in overtime when Tom Brady beat Patrick Mahomes. But after they got through those experiences and then they learned how to win, then you build your way to it. That's how you make a champion. Championships do not come overnight. I know fans like to believe it. I know the analysts like to talk like it's so. But, man, you can go down 9 times out of 10. The wise, wily, winning veterans always win out.
I can't take anything away from that analysis at all. You definitely have to get people in the organization, the locker room, that have been through the trenches in order to keep everybody motivated and in order to show the young folks how to get to that next level. And again, as I said earlier, that is a critical piece in our conversation today. You need that wisdom. You need that understanding of folks that have been through it to teach and pass on to the younger folks so that they understand what it takes in order to get over it. And that's where I guess come in today. And I was trying to screen and find out where Deja is. So if you would do me a favor, hit the number 1, and then I can tell exactly what number is yours, Deja. And then I can bring you up live and get your input into for our conversation. All right, perfect. Good morning, sister from the left coast over there. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
I'm well. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for getting up this morning. I know it's a little early way. I was out that way last week, enjoying some of that sun and sand and whatnot. I wish I was able to bring some with me today because it's freezing over here on the East Coast.
I don't know how you all do it. I was raised in Southern California, so Nevada's cold for me.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's just a season, and there's beauty in that season, to be honest with you. There's a lot of changing colors. There's some slowness to life that you get to enjoy when you go through a season like this, and you get to appreciate things more. You get to know that your cable stays on when you're not home, because if you're snowed in, you actually get to watch it all day. So I always had that question and that concern, like, is this stuff on when I'm gone, or they turn it off, they know when I'm coming home. So, no, it actually stays on all day, and, you know, you're not paying for nothing. But we wanted to have you on. We wanted to have you on as an ally to we black folks and our push for justice and equality in this nation, to talk about what made you feel like you wanted to participate and what has kept you motivated to participate through your years.
So a lot of things, some of it is just plain selfishness. I want to be proud of my country. I want to believe in our founding documents. And I can't do that the way they're treating y'all. So there's some of that, but I've also just kind of always been interested in justice no matter what. I'm the co-sponsor of the Gay Straight Student Alliance at my middle school I teach at, and I actually tried to learn Spanish. Didn't work so well to try and work with that. And it's just basically, you know, looking around and going, these people are suffering. I can't be a part of their suffering. And that means I got to work against their suffering in the system, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, some of it also is just concern for you all. You don't deserve the crap that's going on. And anything I can do to stand there. And particularly, so Rodney calls our local schools, I don't know if it's nationwide or just the local schools, white supremacy madrasas. And I can't argue with that, you know. We've actually got a situation going on right now where one of our white teachers, possibly well-meaning, I kind of have a hard time seeing that, but you never know, people could be stupid, decided that for Black History Month, she was going to have half of the students role play and be slaves, and the other half of the students role play and be their masters, and then the students who were the masters have to write essays about why slavery is good. And I'm just that kind of teacher that when this other teacher did that to him, they came into my room and said, this is what she's got us doing. So I called admin and we're working, you know. He called me back and said, which students are willing to talk about this? And I asked my class and 8 hands went up. So I've passed those on to my supervisor. And with any luck, we're going to nip this in the bud because Black History Month comes for white people to be stupid.
The half that she declared would be the slave masters. Please don't tell me that half was all the white people.
Yeah. And this is the thing you see on Facebook and go, what is wrong with these people?
Okay.
I know I don't understand what it's like to be black, but to tell you the truth, I don't understand my skin folk half the time either.
So you said you grew up in Southern California.
Mm-hmm, San Diego.
Hey. Pretty liberal city.
Nice.
Pretty
that's
liberal
where I grew
city.
Up to with Asia.
Mm-hmm. Rashi said that's where she grew up too.
Yeah.
I thought you were from Kansas City all your life.
No, sir. My mother married a military man, and they went to the naval force down there by Imperial Beach.
Oh,
so I was raised quite a few years down, and it did have a profound effect on my brain because military towns have everybody, Nigerian, Filipino. They were all neighbors, so you smelled their food, you heard their language, you heard their music, and it just changes how you think about the rest of the world. You don't assume, you assume it looks just like that, like everybody is out there.
Okay, fair enough. That was part of my point. Those influences have an influence on you getting involved in the struggle for black folks?
You know, not really. And it's really funny. The biggest influence on me was my grandparents, who were blatantly racist. And they were the ones that believe the kind of racist, because they're different kinds. They were the ones who believed every single stereotype, except Jose and Jamal down the street were okay. And it never occurred to them that if every person they knew was okay and didn't fit the stereotype, maybe there's no value to the stereotype. And so, you know, respect for elders, I never told them to their face or anything, but I spent a good part of my early years listening to racism and just going, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Mm.
You know, but I didn't get there. I mean, and I'm still growing. We got a white supremacist society. I firmly believe as long as you're white and in a white supremacist society, there is some part of racism in you somewhere that you need to keep doing the work. And then when it pops up, you get rid of it, you know?
Gotcha.
But, yeah, so I went through a long period of color blindness of, okay, racism is stupid, we're not different, therefore we must be all the same, before I finally realized I do personally believe that all people are basically the same, let's say at birth, But my America is not your America. And that changes how we are as we grow up. So the colorblind thing don't work either.
Right, right. Right, right, right. Absolutely. Okay. That's cool.
I want to Rodney properly introduce myself. Oh, is Rodney coming in?
Rodney's here.
Okay.
Rodney, jump in, brother. I know you've been working behind the scenes a lot. Rodney, you're hot.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Great. And hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining. Yes, I have been working behind the scenes. We do have some other callers who are guests today who are on the line, and they said they didn't know nothing about sports. So they were just hanging out. But now they're ready to jump in. And so Lisa, Heather, they'll bring you in here shortly. Deja, I appreciate what you said, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted you to be on the show, is because of I have allies, I have friends, and I have friends who are allies. I also have friends who are far from allies. And I wanted someone that could give it to us straight for everybody to hear it as it is coming from the mouth of our allies. And you being an educator, you know, you're the one that's with the future, and we always say it's about the future. So we need to see where those allies who are impacting and influencing our children, where they stand. So please, to all the guests, Heather, Lisa, Sister Deja, give it to us straight. Don't hold back, because that's how we need it, and that's what the audience needs to hear today.
Well, yeah, thank you, Brother Rodney.
So before we go any further, though, and I don't know if Lee can hear me because I see his lips moving, but I don't hear anything. But before we go any further, I want to recommend some books, and I don't want to leave this out. There's a book called Me, and I wish I could show it, but there's a book called Me and White Supremacy, and it says Combat Racism, Change the World, and Become a Good Ancestor by Layla Saad. Get that book. There's another one that is referenced. So that was Me and White Supremacy. There's another one that's referenced in Me and White Supremacy called White Fragility, and that's by Robin DiAngelo. White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And then this is for everybody, and it's a little controversial, and I get some of my Hotep brothers and sisters jump on me for mentioning this one, but this one is called Teaching Black History to White People. Teaching Black History to White People. Now, before you can teach it, you got to know it yourself, right?
Woo!
The history. Learn our history. But then these are tools. These books are tools to help you grow an understanding of white supremacy, how it impacts us all, and each of our roles. And in the book, and then after this, I'm gonna move on to the guests. But I thought it was important to read a definition of allyship. Allyship. And this is from Me and White Supremacy by Layla Saad, because we need to know what we're talking about. And so here it is. A definition of allyship that really resonates for me, and this is Layla Saad talking, is the one by PeerNet BC. They define allyship as, quote, an active, consistent, and challenging practice of unlearning and reevaluating in which a person of privilege seeks to work in solidarity with a marginalized group. Allyship is not an identity. It is a lifelong process of building relationships based on trust, consistency, there's that word again, and accountability with marginalized individuals and member groups. Allyship is not defined. Our work and our efforts must be recognized by the people we seek to ally ourselves with. So that's the working Rodney, definition that we're moving with today. Yes, sir.
Rodney, I have Lisa. Good morning, sister. How are you? Heather, if you hit the number one, yeah. I can find you too. I tried to go through and find you, but I don't think you recognize that was me trying to get you. So just hit the number one. I can bring you up. But Lisa, it's your turn. Good morning, sister. How are you?
Oh, good morning. I'm so honored to be here. Thanks, Lee. Thanks, Rodney, for asking me. I am going to just fall right in step with that Me and White Supremacy book. It changed the way I think about my own allyship, and I can't call myself an ally after reading this book. It's up to those who I am attempting to ally with to consider me an ally, right? I'm not the one that can say, I can say I want to be an ally. I can do things that are consistent with me showing up for racial justice as best I possibly can with information I have. But that book is really, I'm just going to double down on that. So thanks, Rodney, for the Me and White Supremacy. And I actually have a suggestion. I did this book with a group. I had a couple of my best friends and a few other friends of mine get on a Zoom, and we did it for about a year and a half over the pandemic, and it was great. Like once a week, we did a chapter a week. We did a little slower than it I think wants you to do it, but we had really deep discussions, and I think it changed everybody's lives. Everybody's lives, it changed. And these were all folks that were great people. I mean, I heard Deja. Thank you so much, Deja, for your shares and talking about what's going on in LA Unified. I'm actually on the board of No Racism in Schools, hashtag 1865, here in Las Vegas. And we got a mess up here that we're trying to work through and be supportive of and figure out how best we can show up. So it's Me and White Supremacy is it's a workbook. It's not for the faint of heart. It takes it very seriously. I just want to say that. And I have one exception, Rodney. You claim that we didn't know anything about sports. It's not true, my friend. I was just trying to be respectful. All right? Just trying to be respectful. I have all sorts of opinions. And actually,
so who's your
the
team?
Interesting thing is,
who's
so,
your team, Lisa?
So, my team was the 49ers and had
what do you mean was? We're still in it. We're still in it.
Well,
don't do that. We're still in it.
No. We are definitely still in it. When my quarterback Colin Kaepernick was blackballed by the NFL, I stopped being able to watch. And that's just an interesting conversation about allyship. Like, is it virtue signaling for me to wear a Kaepernick jersey? Right? Like, is that all I'm doing? Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thing. Like, yes, I work, like, I'm going to wear my Kaepernick jersey tomorrow. I've got two of them. They're both dirty because I've been wearing them for a couple of weeks. Got to do some laundry. I'm going to wear my Kaepernick jersey tomorrow. But it's, you know.
Hold on. Don't you wash that shirt, girl. That's our lucky jersey. Don't you wash that shirt.
It is.
That's why we're winning.
Right.
You got to keep it dirty until the championship. Yeah, keep it dirty until the Super Bowl is over.
Let me just say, that Super Bowl that we supposedly lost to the New England Patriots, that was freaking, that was pass interference,
that was
Crabtree. We should have won that damn game. Sorry.
We all know how it goes with Brady in the dark one. It is what it is. We all know.
My gosh. Anyway. Absolutely. So, and I agree with everybody. I love the cowgirls. Anyway, I love the cowgirl comment because I'm not a cowgirl fan. So thank you so much for this conversation.
I don't think this allyship is working when you call them the cowboy or the cowgirl.
Oh, my goodness.
when me and Rodney and Lee sat down to really think about this, it came about because we had a semi-show where we discuss what it, how important it is for us to have people outside of ourselves who care about our mission. But it was a dry subject to me because we could not hear those actual voices. We did not hear people say, I want to be in it. I want, and that's where the proof is in the ability to show evidence. And I'd like to show that I'd like to find, you know, to put out there that there is, there has always been allyship between either the people who were in this country originally to the people who came upon the shores. They attempted allyship with them unsuccessfully. When that went down, then they went and got more people. There was an allyship between the indigenous and the Africans that were brought here. We have been trying to use this theory as a working operating procedure for this nation for a long time. But the base core of it is empathy, would you say? Please empathize with people long enough to do work on their behalf. Empathize with people long enough to put your some of your 24 hours, we all get 24 a day, how many of those hours are you willing to spend making sure, as best as you can, that someone else is at least as good off as you are, if not better, at least as able to get resources as you are, at least is able to see themselves reflected in journalism and media as you are. You know the gamut. At least is able to live in a house that doesn't give them black mold as you are. You know the list.
Mm.
At least is able to get a lawyer that doesn't leave them in the prison as you are. Mm-hmm. At least is able. There's a list. It's not theoretical. It's not hypothetical. What we're talking about is no human not living worse than another human within this nation, and it's virtually, it seems insurmountable to me in the struggle, and I can't imagine what it would look like for someone outside, not, I think when I say outside it sounds bad, but not without the struggle inherently placed in their reality. So outside, who says, hey, I'm going to put my, you know, Pilates ropes down for a moment. I'm going to slap this mimosa out of my other hand. And I'm going to get up, and instead of going to brunch, or after brunch, we're going to go mark down here and tell them, you know, to get this housing project right.
Let my
because,
people go.
You know, we're tired of seeing it. Yeah, let's get this. Get somebody. You have an organization here with no black people. We don't like it. Come on, do something about it. You know,
can I chime in real quick, though? Because sometimes I think that we kind of get caught up in the rose tint frames of things. And I just want to clarify a couple of things when allyship really means. And I just mean this from a historical lens. A lot of times, you know, I lived up north my whole entire life. We have this idea of the abolitionist that just was not true. The abolitionists were not kind to black people when they fled up north. They were just as ruthless and as mean to us as white folks were in the south. They just didn't want to own any slaves because they felt like it was a dirty south thing, if you will. And they didn't. They were actually jealous of the money that the southerners was making off of slavery. And so sometimes when we talk about allyship, we have to really keep in mind that allyship does not mean that you come into a different group of people and then make them do the things that you do. You allow them to be who they are so that they can flourish. So a lot of times when we talk about allyship in our community, we talk on assimilation tip. And so we have a lot of assimilators who really want to be white speaking on our behalf, and that's where the problem lies because we ain't going to never be white. You see, we have a different type of culture. We have a different type of thing. Now, we're all human beings. We're all in this human race. That's very important because humanity must always be everything else. But you have to be careful because a lot of times when we talk allyship, what happens is black folks sit at the table and then they fold in. We say we want black people at the table, but we bring in black folks who don't really have black people's desires on their hand. They just want to be what they consider to be better. So we have a lot of milquetoast Negroes who want to sit at the table who say that this is best for us. Can you speak the Queen's English? Can you walk like the king, if you will? Can you wear those suits? That's not always what's best for our people, and we've had a past of that happening. So what I would say about allyship, and I always say this, you can never be allies with people that you can't look at each other as mutual peers. And so at some point, what we have to do is look at ourselves and say, hey, that's a neighbor, I'm a neighbor, and I don't necessarily dictate what's happening in my neighbor's house. The neighbor doesn't dictate what's happening in my house, but we both have a right to decency. We also have a right to pursue the American dream, because what racism is essentially about is denying the opportunities as well as the resources to people who are not white or who are not classified as white. And I had to bring that up because, you know, when the Irish, the Polish, and others came here, they weren't classified as white. They weren't seen as white allies. They were also seen as what they would consider the white niggers. So at the end of the day, we have to be careful in some of the terminology and the things that we use, and we get caught up in really duplicating and doing the same thing over and over again. That's why when you see black men fighting so hard against the womanist movement, that goes back to what happened when we were trying to get out of slavery, when we were trying to get out, because Frederick Douglass had to fight those exact same fights. So we have to really know when we're talking about allyship, that we're talking about the same things, that we're talking about saying, hey, everybody needs to be free to be able to have access. We don't need to limit that access because that's what whiteness does, or the ideal of white supremacy does.
I need to put a pin in it there because, you know, we have other folks on, and I want to get to Heather at this time. Sister, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to join, but I haven't met the rest of you, so it's nice to meet everybody.
Well, I'm the loud one, so... I'm the one that they keep on the leash,
and I'm the one that makes him come back to the 21st century. You know, with his terminology, logic. I keep him on the logic train usually.
They keep me on the leash. That's what they do. That's their job. But it's okay. We make it work. It's harmonious. And I'm the one that Rodney always talks about that takes forever to go anywhere. So just don't pay attention to him. That's not true anymore.
Oh, it's true. There's no doubt. It's true.
Anymore, Rodney. I'm more punctual now. Don't do that. Give people a false impression of me as I am now. But what's your position in this struggle?
So I am a mother to two women. But I think even before I became a mother, I became somebody who was aware of what was happening in the world and how what I was seeing was not consistent with what I was being taught as a younger person. Mm-hmm. And I was constantly sent to the principal when I would ask questions like, why are we not learning about black and brown people, or were there no women that did anything in the course of history? Why aren't we, you know, learning these things? And they would say, you need to go to the office. And I, is that where we learn about the truth? And they'd say, okay, now we have to call your mom.
Oh, baby.
Wow.
And
so y'all must got the encyclopedias in the office, because, you know, that's where the truth is in that.
And that's kind of what would happen is I would go to the library and sit and read things and go back to school and say, well, that's not what I read, because this is before, obviously, the internet and stuff. And I would...
There was a time before the internet?
Yeah,
Google
I would
didn't
ask
exist?
And
come on, you're right. So let me ask you now, your parents, did you have both? Or was it, you know?
Yes, I had both. My father, we came to find out after he passed that he actually had some black blood in his family line closer than, you know, hundreds of years. And we always tried
the first woman either. Okay. What I'm alluding to is, did your parents plant the seeds, because they wouldn't give them it to you at school,
how much of that seed of equity and justice and true reality was home life?
So I would say that it was sort of like a twofold. My father was an attorney, so his idea of justice, I think, was grounded in a sense that justice for all. As I grew into the knowledge of how the world really works, to him and say, but it's not justice for all. And this idea that I had where justice should be for all was planted by my father. And so my expectation was that, okay, well, then that's where fairness lies. And then research it more, that was not where fairness lied. That was where an idea of fairness should be, but was not the reality. And, you know, unlearning what they planted, their garden, it wasn't a bad garden. It was just not a complete garden. I had an incomplete, you know, planting of the seeds. I had half of the idea, more of an ideal than what was the reality.
So I have a question. You said your dad had black lineage that was closer than hundreds of years away. Do you feel like he was passing, or did he, in his heart of hearts, really see himself as a Caucasian male?
I think that he was actually, for the most part, I would say he was probably unaware. But he had some features, and we did the DNA at my request, and I came up with 2.5%, and we know it would be on my dad's side. So when we look, my father had hair that he used a Brillo
was
brush.
Wool?
It was wool hair. And his sister
and
had an
bronze.
Apple. Yeah. And his skin was old. And it's interesting because I raised my son with the idea of Black Jesus, and when he went to a Catholic school in Las Vegas and he was speaking two languages, already in school for a year and a half, and he walked in and he said, and my son is half Trinidadian and Tobago, and he said, "Where is the real picture of Jesus?" And they looked at him and said, "You know, the one where Jesus looks like me." And they said, "Oh, no, you can't come here because he's going to start a whole revolution." And he was only four. So he didn't get
it. Raised that boy right.
So they told me he was not.
But that's it right there. That's it. Okay, now, if you don't mind, the suffering. Because when you join... when you join the liberation struggle, when you join the global, or some would say universal, but at least global, universal struggle for liberation for all people, they don't like you no more.
No, they don't want
you to go to their school. They don't want you on their job. They don't call you to the charity, even if you got money. They don't even want to see you to have to talk to you at the charity for your money. They don't want you. If they know,
they're afraid of what you're going to say when you're in those companies, and that you might start planting seeds. And I have to say, I like to carry my seed packets with me and throw them around everywhere. So you're right; they don't always like me, and I've been accused of crossing over, of not loving white people, and I have a white. Very white looking daughter, and that I must not love her as much as I love my brown looking children. So, and at first that was hurtful, and then it was more just, okay, this is what needs to be said to try and dissuade me, but it won't happen.
I think a lot of that rejection
is they know on some level that this is wrong, that they don't want to take the discomfort to fix it. And so they're walking around in denial, and then you got someone in denial, you try to make them face it, you just hit their crazy button. So I really think that's a lot of it. My favorite is Race Traitor.
Yeah.
Oh, race trainer.
Well, wow. One of the things I want to chime in here too is I keep thinking about this thing that Brian Stevenson says, right? He's the peace and justice guy, equal justice in Alabama, and he says that in order to help folks and be with folks, you have to be proximate, right? You have to be proximate, meaning you have to be connected to each other. And it's the same thing y'all were just saying about sort of where do you start? Like, how do you see this? And I think that white folks in America, because we're talking about allyship, I mean, I read Malcolm X at 22 years old, and it changed my life. Because like Heather, I was like, oh, what have I been missing? What was I lied to about? And so we have an entire country of folks that have been lied to about the reality of racism, of our complicity in it, and and I think somebody just said, you know, you don't want to be uncomfortable. That's it. It's that comfort level of, but to me, it's there's a comfort. There's a huge discomfort and a schism. I think that we're in so much danger right now, just spiritually and holistically, with regards to how we're behaving with one another and towards one another. And I honestly think, in a funny sort of way, Deja had said something about being selfish, right? About doing some of this work selfishly. I think it's better for my humanity. I think that it's the only way I'm going to say. And I think that white folks have to justify history. They have to justify their place, because if they really start seeing the reality, then they will be making. They do have to either one, make changes, and start educating themselves and start dismantling their own internalized white supremacy. And white supremacy is a system. It's not something that you can, you know, grab and take hold, but it's something that we all exist in, right? Every single one of us. So no matter where you come from, if we grew up in this country, really this world, but this country, the normal, the normative, blah, 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 right, that the thing that's lifted up is the whiteness, and you see those messages over and over and over again, no matter how hard you try to unlearn it, you know, I think that's what we're talking about. Yeah.
I want to get into a second, because you said something critical. You said this world, not only this country, but this world. I remember going to Korea, and that was my third continent in, at that time, five, 6 years, some crap like that, whatever. And I was talking to my teacher because I decided to learn the language. Always, I'm big into languages, so I decided to learn the language. And I talked to my teacher, and we were just talking one day, and he was talking about how poorly teachers are paid, but they're treated very well, and like, you know, it's pretty much the same in America. And he started talking about the war and the Korean War. He was an older guy. He wasn't ancient, but he was older. So he was old enough to be a child around the time that it ended or not too long afterward. And he was telling me how the white soldiers told the native Koreans that the black soldiers were coming. The black soldiers had big tails, long slongs, and all they wanted to do was rape their women and eat their food. And we were lazy.
Which is what the white soldiers were probably doing, but okay.
Correct. Correct. Right. And still doing to this day, because they
exactly.
They brought a lot of them back with them. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
As wise. So the system, you know, thinking about a lot of Asians have never actually met a black person, but they're afraid of a black person because of television or movies, because the majority of the roles that black folks could get, especially back in the day, were that of a thief, a pimp, a thug, some type of criminal element. There were not a lot of Shaft. That's why Shaft was such a big movie. There were not a lot of
Sidney Poitier.
The cats. Sidney Poitier's, or I was going to say Uptown Saturday Nights with Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby. There were not a lot of those. So, you know, the negative stereotype about blackness has been projected around the world on purpose, I so believe, in order to keep folks in check. But, you know, what you going to do?
No, listen, if you can't justify whiteness, you can't justify 99% of what's going on in this country right now, right? And that's what I think our struggle is, right? And I, you know, Heather and I are both part of an organization called Showing Up for Racial Justice, and it's a national organization with local chapters, and we're part of the local chapter of Las Vegas. And it really is about showing up for racial justice and understanding how to decenter ourselves, how to show up in a way that is meaningful, that is needed, that is asked for, right? Not just like, there's all sorts of different ways to be an ally, to show up in allyship, right? And I think that one of the dangers is white folks don't want to be, we don't want to be, I'm going to say we, I'm wearing a shirt that says change starts with me, right? And because that's all I have. All I have is from me and my experience. And I grew up in Montana with a teacher dad and really amazing grandparents. Yeah, seriously.
You said Montana.
And so my first, Montana, and a tiny, tiny town
at
the foot of the Rockies.
You don't get much whiter than that.
However, there is a large, the indigenous population in Montana is so marginalized and so hated and so, it's such an awful way to be together in community. You talk about neighbors, and they are so evil to the Native Americans up in Montana. When I was growing up, and my father, thankfully, my dad and my grandparents, stood up for, you know, I have an aunt who's Native, and I actually found out I have 17% Native American in me. That's not little, right? And I wish I had known that growing up. I didn't know that growing up. I found that out, you know, when I did my DNA thingy. But so my first understanding racism was watching how the white folks treated indigenous folks in my world. How completely it just didn't feel right. It just felt, I knew it was wrong at that moment. So, but having said that, I'm digressing. I'm getting off the track. But one of the things I wanted to say was white folks want to be comfortable. We don't want to step in it and be wrong. And one of the tenets of white supremacy is looking good, right? We have to look like we always have it figured out. How, that's such BS because we never have figured out. But the truth is, the only way you're going to learn and you're going to go is to really put yourself out there and educate yourself, and you're going to make mistakes, and that's got to be okay, right? That's got to be okay with folks, and understanding, learning from those mistakes and understanding why. But that's why I love the Surge, because it's about white folks teaching other white folks and not leaning too hard on our Black, Indigenous, and other people of color to sort of give us the education that we all can clearly do for ourselves up to a point, right? We can do that up to a point, but we can talk to each other and figure out how to do it better. And I think that's what we're all talking about here. That's why we're spending time talking about it. But I think that it's deeper than that, right? It's you talked about the world and those white soldiers in Korea, and it's not just that, right? It's today. It's January 6th. It's not yesterday. It's
exactly
today and
what
tomorrow.
We were discussing earlier, ma'am. It seems an insurmountable task. However, the mission is find your. I do believe the old world was bailiwick. Find your dog in this fight and grab it by the leash and wield it, because it is impossible to fight the entire struggle. You can only do one. So
if you are a medical-minded person, there is plenty of injustice being done in the medical field. If you are a legal individual, there is plenty of injustice to tackle in the legal field. If you are an educator, it is up to us to start with the first mind to where they are going to be the ones to say, hey, this ain't right, like the nice lady was saying earlier when she got put into the principal office. It's up to us to know our individual part in the struggle, or else, yes, right, Mr. Rodney, you will make mistakes. You will make plenty of mistakes trying to serve too many struggle masters. So, what has been your dog in the fight? And then what mistakes, like Mr. Rodney asked us to discuss, what mistakes have you made in trying to find your dog in this fight, you know?
Hold on. Before you answer that, make it short because we have one more guest, and I want to give him his proper due and time to speak on everything that we've talked about. And I've been having him waiting in the queue, so I'll let you answer. I'll see Deja answer, and then we'll bring up Dr. G. So the question was to you, what mistakes do you feel like you've made as a participant, as a ally in the struggle? And you've learned from, obviously. Not yet, Deja. Not yet, Deja.
Well,
I want Heather to answer first.
Yeah. I think for me, it's just thinking I know best, thinking I know what other people need before I understand them. That's a big one. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Deja?
For me, it was mostly when I was in my colorblind stage. I mean, I still make mistakes every day, and I'm still a little bit nervous every time I discuss this. But, you know, I learn from my mistakes, so making them isn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. As long as I don't hurt anyone with them. But back in the day when it was all about everybody's exactly the same, I was making a lot of those assimilist my computer just turned off and it surprised me. I was making a lot of those assimilist mistakes of, you know, oh, well, if I just tell Black people how they can fit in better, their lives will be easier, you know. And you know, the white savior crap coming in like I'm all superficial and I'm the center of this. And,
yeah.
How about you, Lisa?
Oh, okay. So, Lisa,
yeah.
I think
I already spoke. Heather can see. Yeah, I was the one that thinking I know
okay.
I know
I'm
better.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, that's good. It's all good.
I apologize.
Okay.
We all sound alike.
I think
exactly.
So do we. I think. I wanted to just say that my dog in the fight. I think my dog has changed. Kind of like I've had different dogs in my life. So, as I've grown and matured, and also have children, you know, my dog used to be, what is the truth? And I know you're lying to me. My dog became, I'm in college or in high school and I'm dating someone and the come to me and tell me that the school is not ready for us to date because he's Black. And then my dog in college became much more active, going to protests or rallies. And then I lived in New York City and worked with people with HIV and AIDS. And so my dog definitely focused on time. And then drug treatment programs, that's a whole unbelievable system of perpetuating and re-perpetuating all kinds of trauma and social work and then being a college professor and then being a mom. So I've had a few different dogs, as you were saying, and I love that analogy. I'm going to take that and run with it. But my mistake was,
as a dog does,
right? And and as a dog does, sometimes they leave their you know, their bodily functions and start all over the place. So, yes, I see myself as a constant gardener now where I try to drop seeds everywhere. But my biggest mistake in the beginning was that I think this naive, not only a desire for it, but thinking that if we just loved each other, then we could understand our shared humanity and that everybody could awareness and knowledge, because it was so logical to me. I was a little Spock. When people say, who is your Star Trek person? Mine was Spock. I was logic. Well, we all share humanity. And if I'm listening in church and you're telling me that we all come from one God, then how are you separating us, right? So it could, none of it made sense to me, because what I thought was true, and I still think that there's a part of that that's true, it didn't translate to how people were treating each other, and it didn't translate to how people were acting with one another. And I had one of my friends from high school, he said, I always wanted to ask you, like, where did you come from, or how did you get like this? And I said, get like what? And he said, I feel like you genuinely like me and have love for me as a person. And I said, I don't know, I guess I heard that and it really resonated with me, but it didn't, I didn't see it in action the way I thought it was supposed to be. And so I think that idealism has served me in some ways, but it also has taken longer for me to unlearn what I was taught, the way I was directed. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
It makes sense.
That was powerful.
Well, look, I want to give Dr. G an opportunity to speak. He's been patiently sitting and waiting and taking this all in. Sir, good afternoon to you. Oh, I'm sorry, still good morning to you on your side of the earth. Good morning to you, sir. How are you?
Good morning. How are you today?
Well,
first of all,
thank you for joining.
Thank you for extending an invitation to me. And I would imagine the invitation came from an ally. And I'm remiss in not participating and being more supportive of him in the past. But he made a special invitation to me to join this morning, and I accepted his invitation because there's nothing that I've asked him to be supportive of me in that he has not, and he is a true ally. So I thank Rodney for giving me the invitation to join you this morning. And as I join, I'll be very frank and honest with you. I had no idea what to expect. However, I tuned in, and I heard a comment from Rodney that I hope quite close and sacred as a teacher of teachers, as a teacher of multicultural education at UNLV. I taught under the premise to my students, and I make this comment very frequently, teachers, you can't teach what you don't know.
Amen.
And in my study of our learning process as a people in this country, prior to the Civil War, it was actually against the law to teach black people to read and write. And then, and I'll just give a real quick little short history lesson. Then after the Civil War, which ended in 1865, by 1870, the Freedmen's Bureau had established about 4,500 schools in the South. And that was great. And the schools were intended to teach the poor, ignorant Negroes. But the question I ask is, what did they teach? Because I know you can't teach what you don't know. So I find myself as a young teacher in the mid-60s teaching in the Desire Project, the second largest housing project in the United States. And I'm at a school where it's 100% black students, 75% black teachers, a black principal, a black area superintendent. And nowhere in that school are we teaching those students anything about African-American history or culture.
Wow.
And as I reflect on that and the fact that you can't teach what you don't know, I realize that all the majority of the teachers, graduates of historical black colleges, end quote, were deprived, like all of us, who are victims of the Eurocentric system of education. And from Carter G. Woodson, I learned to redefine in contemporary terms the miseducation as the Eurocentric system of education. And it is the system of education in place in 99.99999% of the schools in this country, including the historical black colleges, that systematically eliminate any information, knowledge, or history about the culture of African people, not just African people, but of all people of color. And in essence, the system of education in place in this country in a very subliminal fashion, it does it by simply just denying us that right by not including any information in any of their textbooks like our history, our culture. As a matter of fact, I was reading this morning. I'm preparing for a lecture on Carter G. Woodson, and in a book written on the life of Carter G. Woodson, Carter G. Woodson says his first professor of history at Harvard University, where Woodson was the first African American and the only African American descendant of slaves, direct descendant of slaves, to get a PhD, was Carter G. Woodson. And while at Harvard, his initial professor, Professor Cunningham, said to him, and I quote, "The American Negroes are the only people in the history of the world, so far as I know, that became free without any effort of their own. They twangle banjos and hang around railroad station. They sing melodies, spirituals, and believe that some Yankee would soon come along and give them 40 acres and a mule." That was Carter G. Woodson's professor of education at Harvard when he first got there. I need to move along so I can complete my comments. The young lady in your discussion this morning talked about compassion. Very, very significant and important part of our essence as human beings. And that's where we've got to start, with compassion. And another word for compassion is love. And there is no greater or significant love in life than love of self. As a matter of fact, I say there is no more significant or potent knowledge that you can acquire in life than knowledge of self. And it is that knowledge of self that will help you become a true lover. And so I hear another person talking about parenting. I believe my area of expertise, my dissertation was written in parental involvement. My research was written around the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, which was the first significant contribution by the federal government to education in this country. And the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 through Title I required that every school district who got federal funds have a parent advisory committee. So that was the first effort for institutionalized parenting. But in this day and age, at the turn of the 21st century, as a result of my research, study, and documentation, I have come to the conclusion that the most significant problem confronting us as a race, the human race, is what I have come to define as the dying art of parenting.
Amen.
It is what is killing us as a race. And I heard a very interesting comment by another listener about the soldiers in the Korean War. I read recently in my review of Carter G. Woodson's life as a young man. He used to read stories to miners in the mines in West Virginia when he was a young man. None of the miners could read, and he did. And so he began to read to them, and these were some of them were soldiers who had been in the Civil War. And some of the soldiers said to him that they were part of a group of a large group of soldiers who left the United States Army because the Yankee soldiers were telling Confederates and others disparaging stories about black soldiers. And I hear this young lady retorting the information about what the soldiers, I would imagine, in World War II were saying to the Koreans or into the Korean conflict.
Yeah.
And it's history repeating itself. And history will continue to repeat itself as long as we find opposition to phantom things like critical race theory. I won't go into that. That wasn't mentioned this morning. But I heard my time is limited. Okay.
Go ahead.
So I heard a young lady talking about I heard a young lady talking about whiteness, and that recalls a story from my native Louisiana where there was a governor. His name was Huey P. Long, and Huey P. Long said, and I quote, "You can feed all of the pure white people in the state of Louisiana with 1 pound of red beans." Well, I'm
That's
sure
right.
all of you
Just
took
like
the pound
said,
of red beans
in
some time in your life.
Right.
And what he was referencing was on the decline in this country. And it is one of their greatest fears. The research says by mid-century, people of color will be the dominance in this country. So they're about their last-ditch effort for their last civil war under their final leader of the Civil War, Trump.
Professor, people of color have always been the most people on this planet. There has never been a time on the planet.
You're correct.
And so we want to thank you, Baba, because the seeds of knowledge that you have dropped today, they are veins to rivers of other wisdom that can be gained from future conversations. If you are willing to come and educate us again sometime in the future, please say you're willing. Are you?
I'm an ally.
That's what allies do.
She bled on
That's
that one. She bled on that one.
Did you hear that ally speaking? Well, we have another.
How you say
guest.
No to that?
This show is fantastic, by the way. I want to know y'all are killing the. This is the hottest piece of bandwidth happening right now. I can guarantee that. The other guest, Lee, who was that?
In conclusion, I ought to have the right to answer your question. In conclusion, I will be that dog in the fight in the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come on, Professor.
I want folks to have an opportunity to respond to what Doc just said. So we'll do the round robin, and I'm going to start with Brother Barry because he popped back in, so I want to get his input before he has to go out of here. You know, he's up in the great white north, so I know it's cold up there. What you got to say, brother? Thomas? Okay, Thomas took it. He off the reservation. He better be baking me a cake. Rodney, go ahead. You can jump in. Take Thomas, please. I'll get Thomas.
Actually, first of all, thanks, Dr. G. That's what we affectionately call Baba here, Dr. Al Gourier, for sharing those words. What I'd really like to do, though, instead of you all hearing me talk, is I'd like to go back to the guests, and I would like to see what was their takeaway from Dr. G and anything else that they would like to add. I believe we have Lisa, Heather, and I'm not sure if Deja's on the call, so if we could start out with Lisa and then go to Heather.
Yeah, thanks, Rodney. Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. G. That was, you know, it's always, we need more, you know, more learning, more information always. And I think that one of the things that I heard you say that was so powerful was teach what you know. Teach what you know. But there's also something about teaching and the problem is when we have so few teachers of color in our schools, right, and we want our kids to learn more things, there's a whole other show about our educational system, right? So that's kind of one of the things that triggered for me is that absolutely teach what you know. And I think it also combines with somebody else said something about, you know, not fully, well, they didn't say this exactly, but talking about not being able to be fully ourselves. And I think that Deja said something about the mistakes she'd made with colorblindness. And I so appreciate that because I think, you know, that idea and that evolvement into the anti-racist world for me as well was kind of unpacking that and looking at that. And the colorblindness means that we don't see one another fully for the beautiful gifts that we all are. And I think that that's what happens with white folks who aren't in this struggle, who don't show up for racial justice, who don't understand, don't have a diverse community around them. I really think they're the ones missing out because they don't have the fullness of humanity around them. And they're not able to be their full selves because, and whiteness is not a color. It is a concept. That's what I want to say right now. Whiteness, that white supremacy culture is what whiteness is what I talk about when I talk about whiteness, right? And it shows up in a lot of us that identify as white, and it shows up in all the systems that we all participate in. You know, and dismantling that means we have to put it back together. And how are we going to put that back together in the most brilliant, beautiful, fulfilled way is to get all the voices connected and to have it all affirming for everybody, right? Affirm it for all of us. And that just isn't happening. That's not a conversation happening. That doesn't seem to register with the, you know, the very outspoken, you know, they're outspoken racists and not outspoken racists. And they all are doing as much harm, you know, the harm is still there, whether you say it or not. And so that's just what I want to offer. And that's what I heard. I so appreciate this call and this show and what y'all are doing and bringing. And I'm so honored to be a part of it. So thanks again. That's all I got. That's all I got.
Well, thank you. Heather?
Yes, thank you for this show. These are the shows that give me hope. I always tell Rodney that talking with him, it's always good for my soul. And so thank you, everybody, for continuing to show up because ideally as a mother, as an educator, as a healer, I want people to start to understand where is our shared humanity, you know, that we do have that shared humanity, that no matter what, you know, I see one thing that children, right, if children only learn about slavery, Sojourner Truth, and Martin Luther King, and they don't learn about inventors, and they don't learn about, you know, George Washington Carver, and they don't learn about Carter Woodson. They don't learn. My son goes to an HBCU, and when he first came back, I expected him to come back telling me that he was the king of the world and that he was going to be, you know, rocketing into its next formation. And that's not what happened. You know, it was a very assimilation minded school. And, you know, he came home saying that he was unattractive and that he wasn't worthy. And I said, oh, no, no,
what?
No. I said, we need to regroup you here and we need to realign you with your anointing.
Okay.
and your purpose.
Let's not say the name of the school, but what state was that in? What state is that in?
It was in Virginia. And there were great things that happened with the students that he met, but there was an undercurrent there. And we moved him to another school. He's now in Atlanta. And now he is walking in his power and feeling like the king that he is. But the thing that you know, Dr. G, I want to know you more and learn more from you is this idea of compassion but self-love. If you are a child, the only thing that you hear about black or brown excellence is slavery, Sojourner Truth, Martin Luther King, then your concept of self, where do you find yourself there, right? And we talked about allowing people to be who they are and where they are.
Yeah.
How do children start to see themselves as kings and queens if they're not taught about the kings and queens that they are? So, again, yeah.
There are no examples. There are no examples on the shelves in toys. How about that?
And so I tell my son and they come from kings and queens, and they would get into fights at school about that. But I told them, you know, you're going to hear things at home that they won't teach you at school, and I will continue to teach you. And my son would say, why do I have to do extra homework? And I said, because I'm building you, and you need to be built in the way that you really are.
That's proper allyship, yes, ma'am. That's when you, and I've heard so many. So I'd like to, we're talking about a lot of different ways to enact your change. Some people are breeding in, I call it. They're actually creating families and whatnot into the struggle. Some people are in the education. They're educating us about the truth as they can best find it of the struggle. Some of us are dealing with legal ways that they help in the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has seen it ain't, as the kids in the classroom say, this ain't right. And so they have attempted in some way to change it. Change. Change is allyship. What are you going to change? And not miraculously, like you dropped some kind of change bomb. But what kind of incremental change can you do as a person to make sure that injustice and equity is seen in your lifetime? And my favorite new speech is all here now. We want all our rights.
Mm.
We want them right here where we are.
Yeah.
And we want them right now. All here now.
Love that.
And so the more I listen to what Dr. King say, it's more important to me than I have a dream and most other things he has broadcast out there. All here now. And so when you jump onto that struggle, it don't matter which way you get in. All of your rights is all of them. And wherever you are in the world, Africa, Alabama, Kansas City, Minnesota, Virginia, you want them all. You want them right there where you are. And don't allow other people to define when they're going to treat you with justice and equity. It's right now. Right now when I'm in your face. Right now when we're talking. You're going to give me the same respect you give your mama or better.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I want to thank y'all. And I'm going to have to apologize. I have a family thing going on here, and it seems to going to take precedence. I'm outside now. It's so noisy in my house. So please, I'm going to listen to this again later. I love this show so much. You all, please, please go on and keep up the struggle, okay?
Thank you so much. Absolutely.
So one of the questions that we got about 10 more minutes in the show, and this is a question that I've been wanting to ask some people who I thought I would get an accurate answer from. And that's simply, why does it seem that white people are more agitated than ever and maybe as scared as they seem to be in the 60s? and maybe even more so, why does it seem like white people are so angry today?
Oh,
they are losing power. From the sense that they were the only people with power, they're losing it and they know it. They don't understand that this is building toward a better world of shared power.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've never been taught to share, right? White folks weren't raised to think we had to share. The information given to us by society is that we were entitled to it, and I think that that entitlement is the only way you get out of that is by educating. You also, you know, by being, and you're right. It part of the thing too is that the backlash, right? The President Obama and all of a sudden we're post-racial and see this. So there's all this, and then we get Trump right after that, you know? And so I think that that's a very clear sign that there are all these people that were afraid to, quote, say what they thought. Trump allowed them and gave them license to not just say it, but to be celebrated for thinking the heinous things that they did. And it's like it's breeding. It's like that group think, that group mentality. It's mob mentality crap. And I think that that's what's happening now. And I think that that's why it feels insurmountable. It feels very stressful out there for those of us know how dangerous this moment in time is.
Rodney had a question. He was trying to get it in right before. We got out because we got about 7 minutes left in the show. His question is, why does it seem that is it white people are so scared now, maybe even more than the 60s? Was that the question, Rodney, or is it why does it seem that people, I'm not sure, sometimes that bad one.
Lee, actually, that's what they were answering. You broke off for a minute, so I went ahead and asked the question. Lisa and Deja and Lisa responded, and I think Heather's up next.
I'm sorry, you. I apologize. I had to get some water.
I think I agree with what everybody said, and then I remember this book that I had to read in social work school called Compassionate Conservatism. And I think anytime that we make forward moves, it's maybe two steps forward, four steps back, and there's, you know, an idea that that it's compassionate to say pull yourself up by your bootstraps, except if you don't have any straps on your boots or any boots on your feet, then you have nothing to pull up. And so this idea where Martin was trying to connect the masses of people, right, whether just based off of are you struggling and suffering from poverty, that was when he had to be eliminated. Because when you start to bring people together across color lines and racial lines, then you start to create community, right? And so that community is threatening the larger community, because we know that that's what strikes change. When you bring
and that's
people
the wielding of true power.
Right, and the true power
absolutely
is all of that is this compassion and love through awareness that we share this humanity. And when that message becomes powerful and brings people together, then it's very hard to separate them. Like we just saw with the women's movement, it was growing and growing and growing with women trans, you know, intersectionally connecting and women of all backgrounds coming together. Those pink hats were ridiculous, but the rest of the messaging of centering Black and brown women voices, that was coming together and people were coalescing. There had to be a destruction of that quickly and swiftly, and it happened, you know, like that. And it was derailed because thousands of women were starting to come together, and they weren't sure what were those women going to do. And so I think that, you know, this idea of this compassionate conservatism is what prevents a lot of different communities from coming together. And I think the fear is, what is it going to look like if we, who have been in charge for so long, are no longer in charge and no longer centered in the center of this, you know, storm? And I think, like Deja said, people are not recognizing that we are moving into a better place. It's the slowest march ever, but we are getting, you know, in line in that direction. You know, that's where, when you give people hope, that change that is actually compassionate, powerful, and formed out of love, then now you're in trouble. And this backlash of DT coming into office after President Obama, it makes perfect sense in the, you know, two steps forward, four steps, or 4,000 steps back. And he ripped the Band-Aid off the whole country and just revealed, we are not where we think we are. I really believe that he did that. And and we are aware more now, and all the protests, you know, while people were in lockdown and such, really brought to bear, oh, our country is a mess. And more people realized it than have maybe ever realized it before. And I think, like, when your house is a mess, you're in distress. And so the country is now recognizing our house is a mess. Our country is a mess. And what do we do? Wow. It does feel really overwhelming. I think, like the woman was saying before, what is your dog in the fight, you know, and really get in that space and really, you know, not stay in your lane, but maybe optimize your lane until you can move into another lane.
Well, with the last 2 minutes, I want to thank everybody for coming on, and I want to give you all an opportunity to push anything that you may be a part of. If you have a speech coming up, if you got a book that's out, do you? So I'm going to start with Heather. Anything you have coming up that people need to be aware of?
Yes, I have a YouTube channel called Nothing But Love Roundtable Talks, and I actually am in the process of editing a interview that I just did with Sir Rodney Smith, and that will be out within the next 2 weeks. So
okay,
Nothing But Love Roundtable Talks on YouTube.
Lisa?
Yes, sir. We've got a Surge Las Vegas meeting coming up it's always the first Saturday of every month at 10 a.m. Right now we're doing Zoom. It's been hybrid at the UUCLV, Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Las Vegas, is where we usually meet. February's will be on Zoom. You can contact me at lisasf@gmail.com or surgelasvegas@gmail if you want to get in touch with me about that. And also, No Racism in Schools Gala is March 19th.
Deja?
Thank you.
Nothing personally, but No Racism in Schools is having a real hard time at the school board meetings. It's tough, and they're long and grueling. If you've got the fortitude, we could use as many like-minded folks as possible. We're having the same problem a lot of states are having, where these white people come in sometimes armed and then get upset when they're turned away because they're armed, and just screaming about critical race theory and, you know, how we're poisoning the kids by keeping masks on them and all that.
Dr. G?
Yes. I'd like to invite all of the participants to join me for a Chautauqua, part of the African American History Month activities at the West Las Vegas Arts Center on Saturday, February 26th at 2 p.m. at the West Las Vegas Arts Center, 945 West Lake Mead Boulevard in Las Vegas. I'm doing a Chautauqua, and a Chautauqua is a program where a character steps into the life of a famous person and shares a story of the complete history of that person, and then allows the audience to ask the person questions about their life. So on February 26th, I'm going to be doing a Chautauqua, and I will be the presenter, and I will be Carter G. Woodson. So anybody who's interested in finding out why I started Black History, February 26th, February 26th at 2 p.m.
Awesome, awesome. Look, family, that's it for us. Thank you all for calling. Thank you all for listening live. Thank you all for listening later. As we always do about this time, we love you and the damn thing you can do about it. Peace! Until next time.
Ciao.
Thank you.